How should we make decisions like that rationally? That's what this lecture is all about. Decision theory is devoted to the problem and builds on the probabilities we discussed last time. The core concept is simple. I'll start with an example. As a gift, someone has given you a choice of two tickets in small local lotteries. It would be impolite to back out. You have to choose either Lottery 1 or Lottery 2. Lottery 1 offers a 2% chance of winning $100. Lottery 2 offers a 1% chance of winning $150. Which one should you take? Decision theory tells you to take lottery number 1. Here's why. Consider lottery number 1. Take the 2% probability of winning and multiply it times the $100 you might win. Multiply 0.02 times $100 and you get $2. That $2 is called the expected utility of picking lottery number 1. Consider lottery number 2. Take your 1% chance of winning and multiply it by the $150 you might win. That's 0.01 times $150, giving you an expected utility of $1.50. So the expected utility of choosing lottery number 1 is $2. The expected utility of choosing lottery number 2 is $1.50. Decision theory comes with a slogan: maximize expected utility. An expected utility of $2 beats an expected utility of $1.50, so you should choose lottery number 1. All the concepts of decision theory are built into that example. Expected utility always involves multiplying the probability that something will happen times the value or desirability of that thing. Money calculations are easy. But the same principles apply when the values aren't monetary. You still need to calculate the desirability of all the things at stake and the probabilities that various options will get you those things. You pick the option that maximizes probability times value. You maximize expected utility. There are two parts to the basic formula: probability and value. Unfortunately, people are often pretty bad at calculating both of them. Which is greater, the probability of getting mugged in Detroit or of getting mugged in Michigan? When asked that question, a surprising number of people immediately say Detroit. But of course, Detroit is in Michigan. Every Detroit mugging is a Michigan mugging. You can't have a higher probability of being mugged in Detroit than being mugged in Michigan. Why do people say Detroit? It's the image problem again. Despite the fact that Detroiters have made some very positive changes, we have this image of Detroit as a dark and dangerous city, the kind of place where muggers lurk. Our image of Michigan? Farmland and lakes, no muggers in sight. The problem is that people often estimate probabilities based on vivid images. But images are often a bad guide to real probabilities. People miscalculate. They ignore the fact that Detroit is in Michigan. Here's another one. I'll describe someone and then ask you to rank probabilities. Linda is 31 years old, single, outspoken, and very bright. She majored in philosophy. As a student, she was deeply concerned with issues of discrimination and social justice. Where is Linda today? Here are three possibilities. I want you to rank these 1, 2, and 3 in terms of most probable, second most probable, third most probable. Linda works in a bookstore. Linda is an insurance salesperson. Linda works in a bookstore and takes yoga lessons. Which is most probable? The surprising fact is that many people say the third is, that Linda works in a bookstore and takes yoga lessons. Of course, there's no way that can be more probable than she works in a bookstore. Everyone who works in a bookstore and takes yoga is already guaranteed to work in a bookstore. the probability of both is bound to be less than the probability of one or the other. Why do people get the probabilities wrong? They're thinking in images, and they're trying to fill in gaps. Works in a bookstore, takes yoga. That's consistent with what we've been told, and is more vivid because more gaps are filled in. Images are a bad guide to real probabilities, but at least we'll get our calculations of value and desirability right, won't we? Turns out we're vulnerable on that side, too. To begin with, our relative valuations tend to be inconsistent in terms of time. When people have to make a decision now regarding things that will be used over time, their decisions favor variety. Go to the supermarket and pick what snacks you want in your lunches next week. You'll probably pick a variety. Potato chips, barbecue potato chips, Fritos, Doritos. But if you buy a snack from the machine each day next week, the odds are you won't choose such a variety. Day after day, you push the buttons and out come Fritos. Desirability judgments are also alarmingly sensitive to context. We tend to value things in terms of comparisons, and those comparisons are made in context. This isn't news to people in sales and marketing. Real estate agents may show you a very bad house first. It makes the pretty good house they show you next look a lot better. What we consider desirable is also influenced by tags, labels that make us think we should consider certain things more desirable. In a study by researchers at Stanford and Caltech, volunteers were asked to taste a series of wines. These weren't wine experts, just moderate wine drinkers. The wines were labeled by price, $5, $10, $35, $45, and $90 a bottle. But of course, this was a psychological experiment. The wine in the bottle labeled $10 and the bottle labeled $90 was exactly the same wine. The wine in the $5 bottle was the same as the wine in the $45 bottle. But desirability followed the labels rather than the wine itself. Subjects preferred a wine when it came with a more expensive label. That wasn't just putting on airs. In brain scans of the participants, pleasure centers in the brain showed a stronger response to the wine labeled $90 than to the wine labeled $10, even though those were exactly the same wine. Decision theory says the rational way to make decisions is on the basis of expected utility, calculated by multiplying probabilities by desirabilities. That doesn't guarantee that we're going to be very good at estimating either one. The lottery example was a particularly simple case. Just two options, known probabilities, and an easy monetary measure of value. Let me give you a slightly more complicated example. Here, the values aren't purely monetary, and our options have downsides as well as potential winnings. Here's the story. You're invited to someone's house for dinner. Can I bring something, you say? Sure, you bring the wine. Great. You're on your way to their house for dinner, just in time. You've forgotten their phone number, but luckily you know where they live, and you're stopping at the liquor store to buy the wine. The guy behind the counter says, "Would you like white or red?" Uh-oh. You have no idea what's for dinner. You know that white goes best with fish and chicken, and red goes best with beef and pork. You know that red wine with fish and chicken is pretty weird, but white with beef is absolutely awful. You only have enough money for one bottle, unless you get the really cheap stuff. But you're out to impress these people, so that won't work. So which is it to be? Would you like white or red? Decision theory says we have to calculate probabilities times desirabilities. We'll do that with a matrix, working with desirabilities first. It'll start something like this. Across the top, we have dinner possibilities. We'll limit them to fish or chicken and beef or pork. Down the left side, we have the two wine options, white or red. We'll fill in the matrix with our desirabilities. The upper left corner is white with fish or chicken. That's the right wine. The lower right is red with beef or pork. That's another case where we have the right wine. The upper right corner is white with beef or pork. That's the wrong wine. The lower left is red wine with fish or chicken. We can just write in pretty weird. In order to apply decision theory, we have to translate those values into numbers. So here's a proposal. Let's just score things negative 10 to positive 10. The right wine will be worth positive 10 points. The wrong wine will be negative 10. We'll score pretty weird in the middle at 0. That 0 is admittedly a little arbitrary, but luckily this is just an example. If we plug in those numbers, we have a desirability matrix. Decision theory demands that we now add probabilities. So what's the probability that they're going to serve fish or chicken? What are the odds that they're going to serve beef or pork? Perhaps you know enough about your friends to know that they are health conscious and might favor fish or chicken for that reason. But then again, it's a special occasion. You end up guessing that the probability is 70% that they'll be serving fish or chicken. The probability of fish or chicken is the same there in the left column, no matter what kind of wine you buy. So we put a times 0.7 for our probability in both entries on the left. You've estimated only a 30% probability of beef or pork, so we put 0.3 for our probability in both entries on the right. Decision theory demands that we multiply probabilities times desirabilities. When we multiply those out, we get a matrix with values from positive 7 to negative 3. Now for the final stage. We have to look at it from your perspective. You don't have any control over what's for dinner. You only have control over the choice of wine. What we want to do is combine your potential gains and losses on each of your options. If you choose white wine, you have to add together the positive 7 points from the lucky case of fish or chicken with a negative 3 points for the unlucky case of beef or pork. Your final expected utility on the white wine option, 4 points. If you choose red wine, we have to add the 0 for fish or chicken with a positive 3 for beef or pork. Maximize expected utility. 4 beats 3. Decision theory says, go with the white wine. We've said that we are vulnerable in both the probability and the desirability estimates that decision theory demands. We're also vulnerable when it comes to putting those together. Let me give you a problem set up and then ask a couple of questions. We find out that the United States is vulnerable to an outbreak of a particularly deadly type of influenza. If left unchecked, 600 people will die. There are two alternative proposals for combating the disease. Tell me which one we should go for. All scientific indicators tell us that if program A is adopted, 200 people will be saved. If program B is adopted, there's a 1/3 probability that 600 people will be saved and a 2/3 probability that no one will be saved. Which would you go for, program A or program B? 72% of those asked went for option A. The first interesting thing to note is that in terms of decision theory, those options come out exactly the same. In program A, we have 200 people saved, an expected utility of 200 lives saved. In program B, we calculate expected utility by multiplying probability times desirability. A 1/3 probability of 600 saved with 2/3 probability of no one saved gives an expected utility of 1/3 times 600. There again, the expected utility is 200 lives saved. The same expected utility for both programs, 200 lives in each case. So why do 72% of those people who are asked go for option A? Consider a case like that in terms of two different programs. As before, we anticipate a particularly deadly influenza. Left unchecked, 600 people will die. We have two programs, Program C and Program D. If Program C is adopted, 400 people will die. If Program D is adopted, there's a 1/3 probability that no one will die, and a 2/3 probability that 600 people will die. When people were asked to choose between Program C and D, 78% chose D. That makes things even more interesting. C and D are again identical in terms of expected utility. With Program C, we have 400 people dead. Expected utility, 400 dead. With Program D, we have a 1/3 probability of no deaths and a 2/3 probability that 600 will die. Expected utility, 2/3 times 600, or 400 deaths. The expected utility is 400 dead in each case. So why did people go so strongly for option D? The final thing to note is that A, B, C, and D are all identical in terms of decision theory. With 600 people at risk, the A option of 200 alive is the same as the C option of 400 dead, which in terms of expected utility are the same as options B and D. This example and the case of Linda in the bookstore both come from the work of Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. Tversky had died by that time, but Kahneman received the Nobel Prize in Economics for that work. The interesting fact about that is that Kahneman isn't an economist. He's a psychologist. So was Tversky. Why do people make the decisions they do in these cases? Programs A and B are phrased in terms of lives saved. Given a choice between lives saved for sure and just a chance of saving lives, we go for the sure thing. Options C and D, in contrast, are phrased in terms of lives lost. If one option involves a certainty of lives lost, we'll take our chances instead. Tversky and Kahneman put it this way: choices involving gains are often risk-averse. Choices involving losses tend to be risk-taking. That holds in this case, even though the only difference is how the question is phrased. Certain gains and losses are the same in two cases. Risks of gains and losses are the same. But phrase the question in terms of gains, and we decide one way. Phrase it in terms of losses, and we decide a different way. What Kahneman received the Nobel Prize for was prospect theory. Decision theory is all about how people should make decisions. It's a normative theory. It tells you what you rationally should do. Prospect theory is a descriptive theory. It's about how people actually do make decisions. The difference between the two can be put in terms of two graphs. One graph shows the straight line dictated by decision theory. It goes through the zero point at 45 degrees. Losses and gains are perfectly symmetrical. A gain of 2 perfectly counterbalances a loss of 2, for example. A gain of 4 perfectly counterbalances a loss of 4. The other graph shows Tversky and Kahneman's curvy line, intended to track how people actually do view gains and losses. Losses count negatively more than correlate gains count positively. Their graph indicates that's particularly true when it's smaller rather than larger gains that are at stake. Sometimes the decisions we make are irrational, for precisely the reasons that decision theory points up. Sometimes we miscalculate probabilities. Sometimes we think in images instead of taking statistics seriously. Sometimes context will lead us astray as to what we really value. But decision theory, at least as we know it, may also have important limits. Tversky and Kahneman are very careful not to say that the gain-loss differences in valuation are necessarily irrational. They might be right. Economists have long recognized the concept of diminishing marginal utility. Additions of one unit are not always additions of one unit of value. As the units mount up, their individual value may diminish. $1 is probably not worth as much to a billionaire as it is to a homeless person. That's known as diminishing marginal utility. Diminishing marginal utility doesn't threaten the foundations of decision theory. All the calculations we've given are written in terms of utilities, probabilities times what is really valued to the extent that it's valued. If dollars have diminishing marginal utility, we won't always be able to use a straight monetary scale as if it were a straight value scale. The lesson of Tversky and Kahneman may be that we have to do something similar for gains and losses. In at least some contexts, it may be that losses are rationally feared more than gains measured in the same units. Suppose you're living comfortably on an income of $50,000 a year. The prospect of losing that $50,000 is awful. What about the prospect of gaining an extra $50,000? Is that to be desired as much as losing $50,000 is to be feared? My guess is no. There are cases in which potential losses are things we are rational to treat differently than the same potential gains. If decision theory is interpreted in such a way that that's always irrational, we've hit an important limitation. Either the theory or its interpretation need to be changed. Just as dollars have diminished marginal utility in terms of a comparison base, that of the billionaire or the pauper, dollars may have a variable utility in terms of gain and loss. What I hope you'll take home from this lecture are the basics of decision theory. Expected utility is calculated by multiplying the probability of an outcome by its value. How should you make decisions rationally? Calculate probabilities of various outcomes on various options. Choose that option with the highest expected utility. I hope you'll also remember some of the ways that we go wrong in applying such a principle. We mistake vivid images for real probabilities. Even our desirabilities can be irrationally influenced by context. I want to close by taking decision theory into a surprising direction envisaged by one of its founders. Blaise Pascal was born in 1623, one of those wonderful combinations of mathematician and philosopher. He was one of the founders of probability theory and one of the first to outline the fundamentals of decision theory. He did amazing mathematical work while still in his 20s. On the 23rd of November, 1654, between 10:30 and 12:30 at night, Pascal had an intense religious experience. The rest of his life was devoted to theological reflection. Left incomplete at his death was the philosophical work for which he's most remembered, Pascal's Pensées. The thoughts. Let me set the stage for what I want to show you by saying that infinity is a major theme in Pascal's thought. He says, "Nature is an infinite sphere of which the center is everywhere and the circumference nowhere." Perhaps most memorably, "the eternal silence of these infinite spaces terrifies me." I've given you that background on Pascal, decision theory, religion, and infinity, in order to introduce his argument regarding rationality and belief in God. The attempt to offer logical proofs for the existence of God has a long and interesting philosophical history. Pascal's argument is interesting because it isn't really an argument that God exists. It's a decision-theoretic argument. Whether God does or does not exist, Pascal argues, it's rational to believe in him. The argument's known as Pascal's wager. Pascal's argument can be framed as a matrix, exactly like the ones we used before. Across the top, we have two possibilities, that God exists and that he doesn't. Down the side, we have two other possibilities, that you believe or that you don't. That gives us four spaces to fill in. What's going to happen in each of those combinations? Suppose that you don't believe that God exists, and you're right. He doesn't. That's the lower right box. Aren't you smart? I guess we'll have to put you down for lots of smart points. We'll put a value of 100 in that box. Suppose that you believe that God exists and you're wrong. That's the upper right box. All that work for nothing. So we should probably put a 0 in that box. Maybe we'll even mark it down a little for disappointment. We'll put in a value of negative 10. Now suppose that God exists and you believe in him. That's the upper left. What do you stand to gain? Infinite bliss. We'll put down the lazy eight for an infinite gain. Suppose that God exists and you don't believe in Him. That's the lower left. If what they say about hell is true, the payoff here is eternal torment. We'll put down a negative lazy eight. You remember how we calculated the wine case? We took the options under your control, choosing red or white, and added up the values across the rows in order to calculate expected utility. Pascal has us do the same thing here for the options of belief or disbelief. Take the don't believe row on the bottom. What do you stand to gain and lose? You might gain 100 smart points, but you might lose an infinite amount. What's the expected utility of that option? A negative infinity plus 100 smart points is still a negative infinity. That's the expected value of disbelief. What's the expected value across the top row, the belief option? You've got those negative 10 points, but you add those to a positive infinity. Infinity minus any finite amount is still infinity, positive infinity. That's the expected utility of belief. What happened to the probability part? Weren't we supposed to multiply the expected value by the probability of the event? Interestingly, because we've got infinity in the matrix, it doesn't matter what the probabilities are that God exists or that He doesn't. However small a probability you assign to His existence, that probability times infinity will still give you an expected utility of infinity. If you're rational, Pascal thinks, you will maximize expected utility. In this case, you have an infinite everything to gain in the case of belief and an infinite everything to lose in the case of disbelief. The rational option is belief. It's an interesting argument, both because of the use of infinity and the application of decision theory where you might least expect it. Pascal's argument is something like gambling on God. But that would be a pretty cheap ticket into heaven. I expect the cost of admission is a little higher than that. It also looks like a similar argument might justify belief in Santa Claus. He brings toys only to good little girls and boys who believe in him. An argument that justifies belief in Santa Claus is an argument to watch out for. Most philosophers don't take Pascal's wager seriously as a vindication of religious belief. They think it offers some warnings regarding the limits of decision theory. The first warning is that infinity is a difficult concept to deal with in many contexts. And we should probably not be surprised if it's difficult to deal with in decision theory, too. The second warning is this. Be careful how you set up a decision problem. As Pascal sets up the wager, he has just two options across the top. God exists or He doesn't. Given his historical context, that may not be too far-fetched. But many critics since then have said, what about the other possibilities? What about all those other possible gods of ancient Greece and Egypt, some of whom might jealously penalize us for belief in this one? If you add the right infinite counter values in those additional cases, the infinities cancel out. That warning has a practical application, too. Decision theory is made to calculate the expected utility of your various options, probability times desirability. But in order to make any decision between options, it's important, first of all, to have a good grasp of what all your options really are. In the next lecture, we'll take on another aspect of rationality, thinking scientifically. In this lecture, I want to talk about thinking scientifically. Why is that important? Thinking scientifically means putting claims rigorously and systematically to the test. It means holding beliefs about the world up to the world in order to see whether those beliefs are true or not. It's not rational because someone calls it science. If it's real science, it's science because of procedures of rational test. Let me start here. If I asked you to give me a list of scientific disciplines, you'd have no trouble. Physics, chemistry, microbiology, neurophysiology. If I asked you to give me some scientific theories, you'd have no trouble. The theory of relativity in physics, evolutionary theory in biology, maybe string theory. But we're all familiar with things that look like science, that present themselves as science, but that have a whiff of the fake and phony. Astrology, ufology, phrenology, ancient astronauts, those are classified as pseudosciences. When it comes to what side of the fence something is on, science or pseudoscience, people are going to disagree in particular cases. The hardest case I know of is parapsychology. What I want to press here, however, isn't what side of the fence something like parapsychology should fall on. The question I want to press is, what precisely is this fence? What precisely is the difference between science and pseudoscience? That's called the problem of demarcation. How do you draw the line? How do you demarcate science from pseudoscience? The 20th century philosopher most responsible for concentrating on this problem and for presenting one of the most durable and well-known answers to it was Karl Popper. Popper died in Britain as a British citizen, in fact, as Sir Karl Popper. He was 92. But Popper was born in Vienna, Austria, and grew up in the ferment that was Vienna between the late 1800s and the 1920s. Sigmund Freud was working in Vienna, developing the science of psychoanalysis. Popper himself was among a number of people attracted to Marxism, explicitly put forward by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels as a scientific theory of historical forces. Vienna was home to the young philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein and the young mathematician Kurt Gödel. And there was this new theory of space and time, Einstein's theory of relativity. That was certainly an intellectually exciting time, but also a confusing time. Here, side by side, were Freudian psychoanalysis, Marxist theory of history, Einsteinian physics, and some pretty strange philosophy and mathematics. Was it all genuinely scientific, or just some of it? How do you tell the real science from the pseudoscience? That was Popper's problem. Thinking back on that period, Popper wrote later that what troubled him was neither when is a theory true, nor when is a theory acceptable. Quote, "My problem was different. I wish to distinguish between science and pseudoscience, knowing very well that science often errs, and that pseudoscience may happen to stumble on the truth." How do you distinguish science from pseudoscience? There were two answers to Popper's question that were in circulation at that time, an old answer and a new one. Neither of those was good enough for him. So let me give you all three, the old answer, the new answer, and Popper's answer. The old answer was this: the thing that distinguishes science is that it's inductive. It proceeds from experience to theoretical generalizations. That does seem to be true of science. It builds from individual experiences to general theories. But it's not clear that that's what distinguishes science from pseudoscience. One problem is that generalization from experiences seems to characterize many of the things dismissed as pseudosciences. Von Däniken's books on ancient astronauts are filled with specific experiences. Visits to Stonehenge, to the pyramids of Egypt, to the plains of Nazca. He proceeds from these specific examples to a general theory, that we were visited by ancient astronauts. But is that enough to make it science? Perhaps generalization from experience is a necessary condition for something to be scientific, but not a sufficient condition. Popper was dissatisfied with the old answer. But there was also a new answer current in Vienna at the time, an answer associated with a group of scientists and philosophers called the Vienna Circle. The young mathematician Kurt Gödel was a member, and Wittgenstein's Tractatus Logico Philosophicus was a highly respected source. Theirs was the new answer to Popper's question. The mark of science, they said, was verifiability. What makes something scientific is that it's verifiable. There is some piece of empirical or experiential data that could confirm or verify the theory. Popper didn't think that answer was any better. His objection? That verification seemed to come too cheap. It seemed all too easy to verify a theory. The study of Marx or Freud seemed to have the effect of an intellectual conversion or revelation. Quote, once your eyes were thus opened, you saw confirming instances everywhere. The world was full of verifications of the theory. A Marxist couldn't open a newspaper without finding confirming evidence for a Marxist interpretation of history, particularly in the things that weren't said. A Freudian would think his theory confirmed if you said you hated your father, and also confirmed if you said you didn't. That was precisely the problem, said Popper. These theories were all verifiable, all too verifiable. Anything that happened, no matter what, could be taken as verification. Popper's conclusion, this new answer wasn't adequate to distinguish real science from its pretenders either. Popper proposed an alternative. What a theory needed in order to be scientific wasn't verifiability, but falsifiability. A genuinely scientific theory, Popper says, is one that takes risks. A theory that nothing would disconfirm is pseudoscientific. And Freud and Marx are Popper's prime candidates. A genuinely scientific theory isn't like that. It sticks its neck out. Here, Popper's favorite candidate is Einstein's theory of relativity. The time we're talking about was just about the time of the Eddington expedition, intended to test Einstein's theory. Einstein predicted that light would be bent by gravity. If the theory was true, the position of stars photographed during an eclipse should differ from their positions when photographed in the night sky without the gravitational effect of the sun. The Eddington expedition set out to make precisely that comparison. If they came back with photographs that didn't show the effect, Einstein's theory was dead in the water, busted, falsified. It was precisely because Einstein's theory was so clearly falsifiable that Popper took it as the paradigm of genuine science. What about evolution? Is that falsifiable? Or should we put Darwin next to Freud and Marx on the shelf of pseudoscience? Popper initially thought Darwinism was unfalsifiable too. Quote, not a testable scientific theory, but a metaphysical research program. But Darwin himself lays down a potential falsification in The Origin of Species. He says, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous, successive, slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. J.B.S. Haldane, when asked what would disprove evolution, said, fossil rabbits in the Precambrian. Popper's later view was much more nuanced. There are ways to falsify major aspects of evolutionary theory, though really severe tests of natural selection are harder to come by than comparable theories in physics and chemistry, he said. When it comes to influential bits of 20th century philosophy of science, Popper's falsifiability criterion may top the list. Scientists themselves use it as a mark for good science. Yet it still causes confusion. Everyone knows that false is bad. You certainly don't want to brag that your theory of the universe is false. But if false is bad, how can falsifiable be good? What Popper ends up with is an evaluative hierarchy of theories. At the bottom are unfalsifiable theories. Those are theories which no empirical test or data would refute. Their defenders will defend them no matter how things come out. Those are theories that have been insulated against the world that they're supposed to be about. They're not even good enough to be bad scientific theories, says Popper. Those are mere pseudoscience. Go up one step and you have falsifiable theories that have in fact been falsified. Phlogiston theory postulated a special substance in things that explained why they burned. Lamarckian evolutionary theory postulated the inheritance of acquired traits. Newtonian physics postulated absolute space and time. Scientific theories? Absolutely. They took a genuine risk. They could be disproven by experience, and in fact they were. We now know that all those theories are false, but better that than unfalsifiable. On the highest rung, we have falsifiable theories that haven't been falsified. Well, at least not yet. Those are the best of the lot. No theory of any breadth, Popper emphasizes, can ever be conclusively confirmed. There's no point at which we say, confirmed, close the book, and abandon all future testing. We should continue to look for falsifications. We should continue to put our theories to the test. That's the only way we'll find better ones. There are, however, two ways to read the falsifiability criterion. One of them has to do with theories. One of them has to do with people. Popper writes as if he's talking about the theories, as if the theories themselves came intrinsically falsifiable or unfalsifiable, scientific or unscientific. I think it's more important to emphasize how people use theories, whether the people involved are treating the theory as falsifiable or not, whether the people involved are treating it scientifically or not. Take astrology, the theory that our destinies are controlled by the stars under which we're born. Could such a theory be put forward in a falsifiable form? My guess is that it could be. My guess is also that it would be falsified pretty quickly. But at least it would be on the second rung, next to phlogiston theory and Lamarck, scientific but unfortunately falsified. But that's not what the history of astrology looks like. The history of astrology is not a history of people looking for falsifications in order to formulate better theories. It's a history of people making money from fortune-telling. The problem, then, may not be in the theories themselves. It may be in how people handle those theories. Suppose you want to build a pseudoscience. You want a genuinely bogus claim at the core, but one that sounds great, gets lots of attention, but is protected against falsifications precisely because it's unfalsifiable. Suppose you want to build a pseudoscience. How would you do that? You've probably got some good ideas. Lay them out, and you'll know what to watch out for when you're on the receiving end of pseudoscience. Some claims are going to be unfalsifiable just because they come that way. What if I claimed that there is a very strange thing hovering just by your left shoulder? It's a ceratopic IV sphere, roughly 4.5 inches in diameter. It's there all right, but don't expect to see it. The IV of IV sphere stands for invisible. There's an invisible ceratopic IV sphere hovering over your left shoulder. Ceratopic? I just made that up. But it means undetectable by any means that can be manipulated by mammals. There's nothing you can do or say to refute my theory. I can deflect your every objection. You don't see it? Of course not. It's an IV sphere. You can't detect it by touch or with x-rays or a CAT scan? Of course not. It's a ceratopic IV sphere, and you're a mammal. That's an airtight pseudoscientific theory. Unfalsifiability is built right in. There are other ways to make something pseudoscientific. One is to make your theory a moving target. Every time someone tries to refute it, you say, oh, that wasn't exactly my theory. More precisely, and you change the theory a bit. That was the history of Ptolemaic astronomy. In simple form, the Ptolemaic theory held that the planets and the sun circle the Earth. If that were true, all the planets would move uniformly across the night sky. But in fact, they don't. If you plot the positions of Mars against the constellations night by night, you'll find that Mars moves in the same direction for a while, but then starts moving backwards, then moves forward again. It's called retrograde motion. The astrologers, in fact, know all about it and figure it into their predictions for what'll happen in your life. Retrograde motion is an observable fact that doesn't fit the simple Ptolemaic theory. Busted, falsified. But we could modify the theory a bit, and that's what happened. Perhaps what circles the Earth aren't planets, but invisible pivots around which the planets turn. What you see in retrograde motion is the planet going backward around that invisible point. It's called an epicycle. Well, it turns out that theory doesn't fit observations of Mars very well either. Oops. You get a better match if you have the planet circling a point which itself circles a point which goes around the Earth. Well, it turns out that doesn't quite work either. But if you add a further epicycle, epicycles upon epicycles. Things like epicycles are called post hoc modifications, modifications after the fact. Do that often enough and you make your theory unfalsifiable by making it a constantly revised moving target. Ptolemaic astronomers were never conclusively refuted because they just kept adding epicycles. But it turns out there's a much simpler explanation, a sun-centered universe with elliptical orbits. With that simpler explanation, planets are like runners on an elliptical track, and retrograde motion happens when one planet laps another. Built-in undetectability. Post hoc modifications. How else could you make your theory unfalsifiable? A good way is to build on ambiguous phenomena. Use something that's hard to see or that can be interpreted any way you want. In this category falls Percival Lowell's reports of canals on Mars. Lowell was a primary astronomer of the early 1900s. It was he who founded the famous Lowell Observatory in Arizona. Night after night, Lowell peered at the tiny and wavering image of Mars through his optical telescope. He convinced himself that he could see a pattern of canals, and that those canals must have been constructed and navigated by intelligent beings on the red planet. He published Mars and Its Canals in 1906, followed 2 years later with Mars as the Abode of Life. Another tip for building a pseudoscience: build in a stipulation that only the properly trained or the truly initiated can see at work. There is, for example, the famous case of N-rays at the University of Nancy in France in 1903. Shortly after the discovery of X-rays, the discovery of N-rays was announced by René Blondlot, highly respected member of the French Academy of Sciences. N-rays were emitted by certain metals and blocked by lead, as X-rays were. They increased the luminosity of a spark and made luminescent paint glow slightly, and could be bent by metal prisms. No one outside of France seemed able to duplicate Blondlot's experiments. The French claimed they just weren't properly trained. After all, it did take some training to be able to see the increase in spark intensity or paint luminosity. The American physicist Robert Wood volunteered to participate in Blondlot's experiments. But when it was his job to position the metal prism that would bend the N-rays, he palmed it instead. Amazingly, the reports given by Blondlot and his students were the same as if the prism had been in position. The same thing happened when Wood lied about whether a lead screen was in place. Blondlot's students were trained, all right. They were trained to see what they were supposed to see. If you set out to build a pseudoscience, those would all be good ways to do it. Be prepared to shift the theory by adding post hoc modifications, build on ambiguous phenomena, and insist that only the properly trained or the true believers can see the results. All of those will help to make your theory unfalsifiable. Of course, you aren't setting out to build a pseudoscience, at least I hope you're not. But by thinking how you do it, you can see the tricks from the inside. That'll help you recognize them from the outside. That'll help vaccinate you against pseudoscience. But I want you to note that something very strange has happened in the course of this lecture. We started out talking about the demarcation between science on one side, physics, chemistry, microbiology, and so-called pseudosciences on the other, astrology, phrenology, ancient astronauts. The strange thing is that many of the examples I just gave you came from the science side. Ptolemaic astronomy was genuine astronomy. Percival Lowell was a well-respected scientist. René Blondlot's scientific credentials couldn't have been higher. That means that pseudoscience isn't just a problem outside the scientific establishment. Pseudoscience is something to guard against even within the hallowed halls of established science, perhaps especially within the hallowed halls. Let me also point out that neither Lowell nor Blondlot were con men. Lowell really did believe he was seeing canals on Mars. Von Lohe really did believe he could see the increase in spark luminosity. Even the best of scientists can fool themselves by falling for the traps of pseudoscience. The core demand of scientific rationality is that we put things to the test. How precisely do you do that? It sounds easy. You have a theory that says Y happens when X happens. So you make X happen and you see if Y happens. What's so tough about that? Let me give you a simple case. You have four cards in front of you. One has an E on it. Another has a K. One has the number 4 on it. Another has the number 7. E, K, 4, and 7. Here's the theory you want to test. If a card has a vowel on one side, it has an even number on the other. It's your turn to put it to the test. Which cards must be turned over in order to test the theory? We can imagine that each experiment costs a lot of money, but we really want to know whether the theory is true. What is the minimum number of cards you have to turn over to test it? Press pause, take a minute, and think about that. Which cards do you have to turn over to test the theory? The most popular answer is, turn over the E card. And of course, that's right. The theory says if you have a vowel on one side, you have an even number on the other. So we turn over the E and see if there's an even number there. If there is, that's in accord with the theory. Great. If there isn't, the theory is refuted. Falsification. That's a good test. If it comes out one way, we get a confirmation. If it comes out another, we get a falsification. Are there any other cards that would test the theory? The second most popular answer is, turn over the 4 card. But that's definitely not right. If our experiments cost money, turning over the 4 card is a waste of research dollars. Suppose we turn over the 4 card and find a vowel. Then we have a card that fits, if there's a vowel on one side, there's an even number on the other. But what if we don't find a vowel? The theory didn't say, if there's an even number, there's a vowel. It didn't say, only if there's a vowel, is there an even number. So if we turn over the 4 and don't find a vowel, we haven't falsified the theory. All the 4 card can give us is confirmation. Turning over the 4 card can't give us falsification. So it can't really test the theory. The second card we should turn over is the 7 card. Suppose we find a vowel on the other side. Then we have a vowel on one side, an odd number on the other, and we've falsified the theory. That gives us a real test. Even in a case this simple, with only 2 variables, experimental design can be trickier than you might think. What I just showed you is the Wasson selection task, one of the most studied examples in the psychology of reasoning. It's often taken as showing that people have a confirmation bias, that they look for confirmation of a theory, just like Popper said that the Marxists and Freudians did, but don't seek out falsifications, the real test of a theory. Exactly why people do that remains a matter of dispute. One of the strange things about the Wasson selection task is that people don't make the mistake all the time. It seems to depend on context and even on how everyday the problem is. In the way I just presented it, the problem is outlined in abstract terms, vowels and numbers. People rightly see that they should turn over the E, but wrongly say they should turn over the 4, when it's really the 7 they need to turn over in order to test the theory. But people don't tend to make the same error when we change the problem just a little. We'll have 4 cards representing 4 people that you see on the beach. Their ages are on one side, what they're drinking is on the other. We want to turn over cards in order to test this theory. If you're drinking alcohol, you must be over 18. The cards say, drinking beer, drinking Coke, 18, 16. Which cards do you have to turn over to test? If you're drinking alcohol, you must be 18. People say, turn over drinking beer. Right. That's like the E card before. In this context, people see that the other right answer is, turn over the 16 card. Then you'll be able to see if there's underage drinking going on. That's a real test of the theory. The interesting thing is that people don't say, turn over the 18 card. They know that it doesn't matter what's on the other side. If it's alcohol, fine, but if it's not, no falsification. They don't go for that card, although it's doing just what the 4 card did in the previous test. And they did go for the 4 card in the abstract case. So do people have a confirmation bias? Or is it just in unfamiliar or abstract contexts that such a bias appears? The psychologists haven't yet reached consensus on that one. In this lecture, we've emphasized putting it to the test as the core concept of scientific rationality, with an emphasis on the importance of seeking falsifications of a theory. I hope you'll not only remember Popper's falsifiability criterion, but put it to work. But let me close with a few warnings and provisos regarding the role of experiment in science. There are many different sciences, and the role of experiment is going to be different in different sciences. If an organic chemist forms a hypothesis regarding the composition of a specific protein, he can design an experiment and test it. But if a paleoanthropologist forms a hypothesis regarding the origins of Australopithecus afarensis, there's no clear and obvious experiment that would confirm or refute it. Here's another example. There are rival scientific theories as to the formation of the moon, but there's no clear moon-forming experiment we can perform to decide between them. The role of experiment in science is crucial, but it's often unavailable. Sometimes it takes years to invent an experiment that would confirm or disconfirm aspects of a theory. That was true both for parts of Einsteinian relativity and for quantum mechanics. Sometimes the results of an experiment are clear, but it may take decades to produce a theory for which those results will serve as confirmation. In On the Nature of Things, written about 60 BCE, the philosopher Lucretius notes the random motion of motes in sunlight. In 1828, a botanist named Robert Brown noted the same phenomena in grains of pollen suspended in still water. Those random little jerks became known as Brownian motion. The phenomenon was widely known for decades, easily repeatable, and a complete mystery. An experiment in search of a theory. Einstein's 1905 doctoral dissertation developed a statistical molecular theory of liquids. Among other things, it finally offered a theory for Brownian motion. When we do have experimental evidence for a theory, it's often indirect. We can't afford, either economically or ethically, to perform wide-scale social experiments that would answer some of the questions we'd like to know the answer to. Whether the death penalty deters murder. Whether pornography leads to rape. What experimental evidence we do have regarding those questions has to be extrapolated from social psychological experiments involving small groups of people in relatively artificial circumstances. Scientific rationality does demand that we put hypotheses to the test. Any theory that waved away empirical test as irrelevant would clearly be an unscientific theory. But the role of experiment is often more elusive, harder, and more indirect than it might seem. Putting it to the test is often harder than it might seem. In the next lecture, I want to take that further by examining some of the really beautiful experiments in the history of science. On January 28, 1986, the Space Shuttle Challenger lifted off at the Kennedy Space Center. The launch was broadcast live, with many classrooms watching, because Christa McAuliffe was among the crew as the first member of the Teacher in Space project. 73 seconds into the flight, the Challenger disintegrated in the cold skies over the Atlantic, instantly killing all aboard. What caused the crash? To answer that question, President Ronald Reagan set up the Rogers Commission, named after its chair, former Secretary of State William P. Rogers. Also on the commission were Charles Yeager, the first person to break the sound barrier, Neil Armstrong, the first person to walk on the moon, Sally Ride, the first American woman in space, and, with reluctance, the physicist Richard Feynman. The most famous moment in the commission's work occurred during a televised hearing. The subject was the temperature at which the flight had been launched and the O-rings that sealed a joint